contribute to our very own Frederick Schuller, who said talked about this piece of work. Please.
Okay, thanks all for coming. So the title sounds a bit physical, and it's just to get you here. So I would like to talk about the classical limiting form of gravity in an accelerating universe. And so possibly the whole claim or this proves is a bit pretentious, but even if you don't believe the actual result, I think the technique and what it tells us about geometry of events in space-time, it might be quite interesting. But I think there is a connection to what we know about classical limiting form of gravity.
Just reached the classical.
Yes, something happened. It was strange. Yeah, sorry about that. I don't know. So the cosmological constant problem, the cosmological puzzle, is kind of the following. So we all know these Einstein-Hilbert equations where the geometry is determined by matter. And so this was adopted at a time where people thought that when it comes to space, there must be a vacuum solution of the theory. But now recent observations seem to indicate in a conclusive way that the universe expands at an accelerating rate. And if you start from Einstein-Hilbert gravity, the way to incorporate that into the theory, into this theoretical picture, is to adopt this additional cosmological constant term, which is lambda. And if you still insist on a strong energy condition, you see a lambda must be a constant throughout. Actually, acceleration means lambda must be positive. Now, the cosmological constant puzzle, in short, is the question, if this is a constant, so then it presents, if I take GR in its normal interpretation, it presents a ubiquitous vacuum energy you have everywhere, ubiquitous. And but what is the physical origin of this vacuum energy? And this problem is so puzzling because you might think, okay, we have standard model fields living in our space-time. And so possibly this lambda comes from the vacuum fluctuations of these standard model fields. And you can argue which of these standard model fields should participate in that. But however careful you are, at least of 40 orders of magnitude from these calculations of the actually observed value. So it doesn't really seem like that this can explain it. So the question remains, what's the physical origin of this vacuum energy? And many people would argue that this problem smells kind of like quantum gravity because it has to do with very small numbers, it has to do with gravity in the first place, and this ubiquitous vacuum energy, so something could have to do with the property of space everywhere. So in that sense, you kind of think it has to do with quantum gravity. So addressing this question, therefore, what it means to understand the space-time structure at very short distances. And well, we all know that this is the key open problem of theoretical, fundamental theoretical physics today, and therefore it's pretty obvious that I'm not going to tell you how that is.
Can you just have a curiosity, what is this exact term that you're referring to when you say that the strong energy condition is why it's right at this time?
Well, if you see, you would like to have that del of the energy momentum part here. I mean, because here you have the Bianchi identity on the left-hand side, so that induces that the right-hand side must vanish if I apply the delta operator to it. Now you assume that T is ordinary matter for which you would assume that. But then this term here, the del on the G, clearly gives you a zero. Now if this lambda depends on positions as well, then we have an additional term where there are lambda GLB features, and unless lambda is a constant, covariantly constant, this term will not vanish and therefore upset the Bayankian identity.
Yeah, so where do you use, I don't see where you use Bayankian conditioning that argument. I thought all you used was that ordinary matter has its separate conservation law. Didn't you just say that the divergence of CAB is zero?
My statement would be that the total energy momentum tensor, if that is zero, then you have that's a strong energy condition.
Oh, I would mean something different by the strong energy.
Oh, okay. So, okay. No, okay, that's what I meant. So how would you call this?
There's something just technically called
just conservation law. Okay,
fine. There's something that people call the strong energy condition, which is somewhat peculiar condition relating the eigenvalues of TAD
right
to each other.
No, I had this in mind, so if I come along with this, it's not standard, of course, to be wrong. I always call this like that, but okay, fine. Thanks for the remark. Okay, so this is a very difficult problem indeed, but on the other hand, I think if one gets clear about what one is talking here, possibly this question is not, one can learn something, they need to follow. When we talk about the cosmological constant, we of course need an interpretation of this accelerating universe in terms of the old framework. So actually the cosmological constant field is a classical concept because we kind of fix the classical theory such that it applies to this observation. Now, assume there is an underlying quantum structure under our Lorentzian manifold. This is just kind of some classical limit or some emergent property of this quantum structure. Well, however, we do not know what this quantum structure is. And for the same reason, in visual models, it's also not entirely clear how the Lorentzian manifold actually emerges from this. But it's much more the opposite. We kind of, our thinking takes place in the standard classical picture, and we have some hints as to why we think there should be this quantum structure. And this lambda, in the end, as understood here, is such a classical signature, if this is true, this is a quantum gravity question, that the lambda is a classical signature of whatever underlying quantum structure. So, therefore, this problem or some information about this problem might not be as hard as fully understanding quantum gravity, but rather as understanding the possible classical signatures of quantum gravity. And I would like to argue today that these possible classical signatures are surprisingly limited. So in order to do that, let's first consider classical gravity. Newtonian gravity, so we have the Earth and we let something fall in some gravitational potential, and so clearly this particle would be subject to this Lorentz force law, this gravitational Newtonian potential phi. Now if we consider a particle very nearby, and the nearby being given by a very small displacement vector y, then clearly the trajectory of this one would be governed by x plus y double dot equals the divergence of the potential at x plus y. Now we can Taylor expand that and use this equation, and then we find that the equation for this, only for this displacement vector, is something like y double dot is then this tensor, this Hessian matrix of the scalar potential times the displacement itself. Now this is exactly the harmonic oscillator if this potential wouldn't change along this line here, but we clearly see that neighboring particle subject to gravitation kind of oscillate around others, but not in a harmonic way because of the potential changes. So this is kind of the Newtonian deviation equation, and so this is the tidal force tensor, and that divergence as we go towards the singularity, and so on. So this is a simple exercise for Newtonian mechanics, and I just mention that again in order to give you the right physical intuition about what I'm going to talk in the space-time picture. We need to consider a congruence, so a collection of a smooth vector field of a geodesic vector field timeline. So this, these gray arrows, this is the geodesic place we have no tolerance in the world. And clearly, in GR, the geodesics are the freely falling particles, so that's the logical equivalent to these particles subject to the gravitational force. And here you can also study this deviation, but in order to do so, because we don't have these absolute coordinates in the background, we need to connect these integral curves with each other by a connecting vector field, which is one whose Lie bracket with this expected field vanishes, so we get nice intersecting coordinate matrices. And so this is geodesic, this connecting field. And now, just using the definition of Riemann curvature of this space-time, you find that the derivative of this deviation vector along this time-like geodesic, the second derivative, is exactly the Riemann tensor evaluated at x, y, and x. So this equation is logically at the same level as here. You see, again, it looks like a monopole. So we have that, and so this red thing is the acceleration of this gray geodesic with respect to this white one measured right here. Now, there is a great choice in which connecting vector field you choose. You could choose one which kind of connects it in a different way. There are many, many ways to choose that. So this thing itself cannot have any direct physical meaning. But what you can do, you can project this acceleration vector in the direction you have chosen. So we just look at this solid component here. And then you find that actually this acceleration in this direction is given by the quotient of the Riemann tensor and this g. And this g is nothing but the area of the parallelogram spanned by x and y. And this times this y. Now, this looks remarkably more complicated than the line above, but it's a much more interesting expression, because this quotient here is invariant if I change, if I do arbitrary GL2 transformations between this x vector, and the y vector. So that means this quotient does not depend on this x and y individually, but only on the plane spanned by the x and y. Okay? And so we get rid of this arbitrariness of the vector field y, we can choose it differently, but because you could change your basis in this plane anyway, this becomes a physically meaningful quantity. And actually, if you look at this, think of a sphere, so the Riemannian context, you take on a sphere neighboring geodesics, so two great circles close to each other. And if you now choose one of these great circles as your reference geodesic and you draw it as a straight line, you will see that the other one will harmoniously oscillate around it. And exactly this expression here, R over G, is the frequency with which it will oscillate. So this is actually a harmonic oscillator if the curvature is constant. This is the case on the sphere. So, now, let's conduct the thought experiment. This is heuristic, so your comments are welcome, but it's just a thought to motivate the mathematics of the thought. So the thought experiment is the following. So assume the universe is what we can actually do. We have curved space-time as a background, and we consider standard model quantum fields on this curved space-time. So that's our setup. And now the Unruh effect tells us the following. If we have two inertial observers, then we have this white one and the gray one. You see that because the curvature of space, although both are inertial, there's a relative acceleration. Now, if one observer detects a quantum vacuum, the Unruh effect tells us that the other observer B detects a thermal state. That is, the other observer does not agree with this one that there are no particles present. Now, he sees so many particles in a thermal distribution that this other observer would see a temperature. Okay. So now, if we take Planck scale physics seriously, then one can show actually that there is an upper limit to temperatures, namely the Planck temperature really presents it by a rather clear mechanism. And that is an argument that has been made in some detail by Sakharov. Now, that's this. Now let's make one more ingredient. Okay, already from here you see that if the tidal accelerations produce temperatures, and the temperatures have an upper bound, so do the tidal accelerations. And therefore, so do these frequencies how fast one thing can oscillate around the other. That's my heuristic argument, and I argue that this quotient, actually by the combination of these two effects, quantum effects, has to be bounded. Now, this gives us an upper bound on these final accelerations, but and I have been trying to come up with an argument why there should also be a lower bound, because I need that in order to get interesting results. And so I understand from some work on causal sets that there, by counting elements in the past, because there you can actually count them like integer numbers, you get a hierarchy, a dimensionless hierarchy, and if you have a small length scale, you can produce a large length scale as well. So you kind of have a kind of duality. If you have a small one, you also have a large one. So let's assume this is also something which we take from this idea that the breakdown of Lorentzian manifold to some quantum structure, at least in this transitional area, might be quite well described by causal sets. So these are kind of my heuristic vague assumptions, but the point I would like to make is that these higher frequencies, so this quotient here, are bounded by quantum mechanisms. Okay? So this is, of course, heuristic, and in the following I will be precise in what I say. This is my physical motivation. So if you believe this is very flawed, or it's not what you would say, then just take this what follows as an exercise in Lorentz geometry.
So,
yeah.
I think I understand the last idea you used for causal sets.
Okay, the idea is I have an upper bound to accelerations from this one. Mm-hmm. And accelerations are inverse lengths. Okay. And so if you have a small, so a high acceleration, upper bound would correspond to the small length scale. But if the small length scale is associated with a large length scale by construction, so to speak, then you can argue that you also get a lower bound.
This is what I can do. Okay. This one, that small length scale corresponds.
Well, I mean, we have the experimental models, of course, but I mean, my understanding is that if you take some point in space time and you go back, you assume it's not eternal, but kind of started somewhere, and so, and then you can kind of count, so to speak, the points in there, because this causal set is discrete. And I mean, every Lorentzian manifold would be a causal set if it wasn't, that it's not discrete. So, I mean, if you know the causal structure and you know the volume information, you can fully reconstruct the metric. That's the result of differential geometry. Now here, you kind of know the volume information by simple counting, and therefore you can kind of reconstruct the structure by only knowing causal relations between the elements. Now my point is, this is a big number n elements here. And if you have a small length scale l, you multiply it by n, you get a very large length. So in that sense, I mean, I'm not 100% satisfied with this argument. If there's a better one, I would be happy to know it. But I would like to assume that by some quantum mechanism, these kind of frequencies are bounded. So that's actually my starting point. I could start from there. I want to do this connection. Now, this sounds like a good program, and immediately you see this program seems to meet an insurmountable hurdle, namely the rigidity theorems. For Riemannian manifolds, you have a sphere, and that has clearly constant sectional curvature everywhere. And you have unbounded sectional. If you have an ellipsoid, it also has bounded sectional curvature, but clearly not constant sectional curvature. That's for Riemannian manifolds. For Lorentzian manifolds, however, if a manifold has the tidal frequencies bounded, sorry, if you use sectional curvature, it's coming soon, tidal accelerations bounded, that means only manifolds of constant curvature have this property. So anything else but Minkowski de Sitter or anti de Sitter space, anything else, any other Lorentzian manifold, you find at each point a plane, a tidal acceleration that's arbitrarily high. This is a differential geometry theorem, so this is surprising but correct. So that means you cannot do this without getting only boring manifolds. But, so there have been proposals by mathematicians to do things that circumvent this, but in my opinion, so none of those is physically interesting. And actually, it is ironically, a way to circumvent that, which is very mathematical because it is a structural insight, and I'll show how to understand this theorem from that point of view, and then we automatically know how to circumvent it. Okay, so we will bound these type explorations, but just not all of them.
So what we have is a local theory of bounds and regarding super dimension. And usually this is very surprising to use the mathematical theory in a physical form. So it must be a rare one, which is why you're in the focus.
Exactly. So the point is we would like to do something from this heuristic argument. You see, quite literally, this is too strong. Okay, so we have to weaken it in order to do it. And okay, so we need some terminology, but it's just this page, I think it's quite interesting. So I need to tell you what varieties are. So assume you have a vector space V, can you consider a subset of the vector space? Well, that can be anything. If this subspace is described by a linear equation, we know it's a subvector space, and you can use linear algebra, you know what you do with that. However, there's another interesting case, namely if this subset is given by a family of polynomials, so that, for example, a parabola in R2 would be a variety in R2. And so that's the subject of algebraic geometry. And so one interesting example is take R3, for example, that's what I have here, and take the polynomial given as the inner product of the vectors with the Minkowski vector, is clearly a polynomial, and the vanishing of this defines, of course, this light cone surface. So the light cone is a variety in R3, or also, of course, in higher dimensions. That's a variety. Easy enough. Now, this is one variety, but there is an easy way to understand how you can glue together intersect varieties in order to get varieties. And that is once you define that varieties are the closed sets of a topology that we call the Zariski topology on the vector space. And usually we define topologies in terms of open sets, but you can equally do it with closed sets. It's just that this intersection and unification theorems are just swapped because of the Morgan's rule. So the topology is a selection of subsets in this V, such that the empty set in the V itself is a closed set. That if you have a family of arbitrarily many closed sets, then the intersection of all those is closed. And if you have finitely many closed sets, then the finite unification of those is closed, which means if you have finitely many varieties, you can unify them and you get a variety, but even if you have arbitrarily many varieties, you can intersect them and the result will always be a variety. It's a very convenient way because we will glue together and take apart. And then this is the easiest way to think about it. So for example, this is a variety, this in a vector subspace is two, but that's also polynomial. So this is a variety, and here we use this axiom and we can glue it together, so this thing is also a variety. Now, more to the heart of what we're actually doing, the space of oriented areas. So take arbitrary dimensional space, an area spanned by two vectors has clearly orientation, but the area also means kind of how big this area is. This is the oriented areas. So clearly, you normally give me a vector and you give me another vector, but you don't care about which ones they are, as long as you can do special linear transformations to change the spaces, because this SL will not change the areas spanned by those. So these are really the areas, and the vectors give you the orientation. So this is this object, but you can also describe this by taking an anti-symmetric 2 tensor, so this is lambda 2, now it means anti-symmetric tensors of rank 2, and but not all of those describe these little parallelograms, but only those which can be written as a direct wedge, anti-symmetrized outer product of two vectors. And there's actually a nice condition for that omega can be written like this if and only if the wedge of omega itself vanishes. But this is clearly a polynomial condition. The space of anti-symmetric two tensors is clearly a vector space, so this whole thing is clearly a variety. Okay, so one might think, oh, these planes, they are also vector space. No, they're not, they're a variety. Now, there's one more notion that we need to introduce, that's the notion of a projective variety. assume you do not embed this polynomial into vector space, but into a projective space. So a projective space is a space where two elements are identified if they are linearly dependent. And why is the projective variety important for us? Well, we're not interested in the oriented areas, but we're only interested in the planes. The area that span doesn't really interest us, so we do not have this SL2R invariance, but this GL2R, we can arbitrarily rescale, and that's the space of planes, and you see this GL2R came up before, because our tidal accelerations only depend on the vector of the inertial observer and this connecting vector. Right? So this is actually the object we need for our tidal accelerations, and you see it is again these elements in now in the projective space, because you can arbitrarily rescale, but it's the same simplicity condition here that you can decompose this two tensors into the product of two vectors. And this is generally called the two Grassmannians, which should be downstairs. So that's the Grassmannian, it's the space of planes. Okay? And it's not a vector space, it's a projective variety. And we'll see why that will be important.
It's not vector.
Okay.
So just keep topology. In the vector space, is it something different from just the ordinary vector space topology?
Oh, absolutely, because you see, look, okay, so for example, this here is supposed to be the whole plane, infinitely extended, and this is a closed set. So correspondingly,
you're saying it's a topology in which, how is it defined? Is it a topology in which all the varieties are closed?
Exactly. So the closed, so that's the definition. So the closed sets of this aristic topology are defined to be the varieties. It's clearly, I think it's non-Hausdorff, for example. Yeah, because,
Are you planning to use that topology?
I mean, one way is, for example, I mean, it's a rather, so actually this study of, I'm not an expert in algebraic geometry, but the point is the study of these polynomials embedded in this form has a long history in mathematics. Now the point is, apparently when I read the breakthrough came, once people looked at it from a topological point of view, and they actually disproved theorems that were formally proven, because kind of you see that some things didn't kind of, were not like you see. So this is very central in that subject. I'm only bringing up not to show off with it, but because it gives you an easy intuition of how you can glue them together and intersect them and so on, because we're going to do that. So that's the definition. Okay. We will be concerned with this Grassmannian, but I want you to keep in mind it's a variety. Now, let's go to what's called sectional curvature. Well, sectional curvature is actually the posh name for this quotient that I introduced, so this frequency by which nearby geodesics oscillate around each other. Again, it's the Riemann tensor evaluated at x, y, in these two vectors, divided by the area of the parallelogram spanned by x and y. And by omega, we describe exactly this plane described by these two vectors. Not the vectors individually matter, only the plane spanned by them. And now, so I said this lambda 2, the space of anti-symmetric two things, is a vector space. And in fact, it inherits the metric from the tangent space. In the tangent space, you understand the space-time metric acting as an inner product. And this G here that I defined before is the inherited metric, and it shares all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. And we can actually show that really, whatever vectors you choose here, if you span the same plane, they give the same number here. This definition is well defined. Now, for mathematicians routinely use these sectional curvatures instead of the Riemann tensor because it's a more handy object. And on Riemannian manifolds, everything is fine. This G, this induced metric on this space, is positive definite. And this S is real. This is a variety. The real numbers are variety. You have a map from a variety to a variety. There's a variety morphism. And structurally, everything is fine. Okay. In particular, we have not this rigidity result. My example from before, the ellipsoid has bound but non-constant sectional curvature, which seems reasonable. But as soon as we go to Lorentzian manifolds, this breaks down. We have a strong rigidity result alluded to before. And indeed, there's a proof how we do that. The proof is technical and not so insightful. But I think there's insight to be had, maybe in the Lorentzian case, its induced metric is also indefinite. So this big metric on this space. And this S here is only defined on non-null planes. The null plane is one that lies like so, but this area of the null plane vanishes. So you can't take this quotient. So on Lorentzian manifolds, you must modify this definition of the sexual curvature. Namely, you must define it only, it can be defined on all planes, but only on those that are non-null. You have to exclude those. Now you see, GR, the Grassmannian in the space of planes, is a variety. I showed that before. Now we intersect with something. Now if this other something is a variety, then clearly the whole thing would be a variety, and the whole map would be nice. But this is an unequal sign, so this intersection is not defined by a variety, so the whole thing is not a variety. So in the Lorentzian manifold, people usually restrict this map to a non-subvariety. This is like in linear algebra, you would restrict something to a non-linear subspace. Well, you can no longer say it's a sensible map. It doesn't induce a sensible map. So, and my potential is that the Nomizzo-Harris rigidity theory essentially roots in such an unnatural restriction. Okay? Well, but taking that point of view, it seems reasonable to try to circumvent this rigidity theorem by a restriction to the maximal subvariety that is left after you took out light-like planes. So you must restrict still more, not only to the non-null planes, but to the maximal subvariety, the maximum good set that is left.
So you're restricting what to this?
So this map is defined on planes, but the question is which planes? Certainly in the Lorentzian case, not the null planes. But if you only take out those, you have an unnatural restriction, and you get these rigidity theorems. So my strategy is to say, okay, let's restrict to, I mean, we must take out the null planes, but let's take out more such that we end up with subvariety, so that the restriction becomes a good one, but a structurally good one. So that's the strategy, and the point is it works out, and we'll see the results. Okay? Yeah?
So it's really the reason why you have, in the Taylor-Lyman case, unavoidably the principle of infinite sexual curvatures occurring in non-trivial cases, is the reason that exactly you can approach zero in the denominator.
Exactly.
What is the basic implication of that? It seems that if you have some pilot force and you have an observer which is traveling very fast, he sees everything happening in. Let's say you have some experiment, some pilot force is happening to two objects, or drift apart from each other, let's say, because of pilot forces. That drifting apart may go much faster to an observer that is traveling very fast. So that he sees this as being due to a large tidal force.
Okay.
So how do we avoid this?
So we'll see in very clear examples what this restriction will be in special cases and so on. I give a general construction of examples. The quick answer is the idea of a fast observer is of course not a covariant one. If you tell me fast observer, ask you what does it mean geometrically.
Yeah.
So what you actually want, we will see that if you have a gravitational wave, then you're lost. You have no chance of restricting things. And that has to do with these null directions, really, because the travels at the speed. We will see exact examples.
It seems to me that this is only true for strict classical theory. Because in the quantum gravity theory, you would think that light flowing could see the left.
Yeah. Well, but that's
case,
I really appreciate that. The philosophy behind this is that I say, okay, if there's an underlying structure, one of the structure, which we simply do not know what it is, what possible imprint could it have on the smooth magnet? So this is semi-classical in the sense of Bohr. He uses angular momentum and he uses trajectories and everything. But he has additional constraints like angular momentum is quantized. So he uses classical notions for which he can speak precisely and has additional requirements. That is my strategy. Let's talk about things which we have mathematically under control, but we have these bounds. Okay? So I'm not claiming this is quantum gravity, but I think it has to do with the signatures of quantum gravity on large scale. Okay, so what I want to say, if you want to restrict this in a more sensible way, And okay, so I'll tell you how to construct this maximal subvariety of all normal things. Several simple steps. First, we have a Riemann case. Yeah.
You're telling me this is the unique size of the maximal subvariety.
Yeah. Let me finish this. If you ask the question again, in a moment, then I'll comment on based on what I'm going to say. So, consider the Riemann tensor, which has naturally an index up and three indices down. If you don't have a metric, so that would be naturally this. But we have a metric, so we pull up the second index, and then we have three indices up and down, and the Riemann symmetries in the presence, it comes from a metric geometry, is anti-symmetric here and anti-symmetric there. So this defines an endomorphism R on the space of anti-symmetric two tensors. Give me an anti-symmetric two tensor, you contract with this and you get an anti-symmetric two tensor. Moreover, this G that I defined is the metric on the space, and this guy is really symmetric with respect to that metric. It's pretty very nice. We have a symmetric endomorphism. Now, that's the first thing. So consider the Riemann tensor as endomorphism. Second, this is an endomorphism, so we can look for eigenvectors. We can look for time-like eigenvectors, time-like now meaning being negative under this big metric, so this would be time-like things, and space-like being positive. So these eigenvectors will in general not be planes because they don't satisfy the simplicity condition that they can be described by two vectors, but nevertheless, we take these eigenvectors. Now, if our signature of the underlying space was Euclidean, then the signature of this big G would be Euclidean. Then we would have an endomorphism that's symmetric with respect to a definite metric, and we knew we could always diagonalize. Okay? In that case, in the remaining case, we would have D minus 1 time-like eigenplanes, that's more eigenvectors of this R, and D minus 1, D minus 2 half space, so the fundamental is 3 and 3. However, because this metric is not definite in the Lorentzian case, we cannot necessarily diagonalize the Riemann tensor fully, meaning we cannot find necessarily the maximum number of eigenvectors. But I don't care, I look for as many as I can find. It turns out, for example, for a static spherical symmetric space times, it is fully diagonalized. So for interesting examples, not really examples, it's like one regression force, but it's not clear in general. Okay, so we find these eigenvectors in this lambda 2 space. And now the final step is we do not intersect with all non-null planes, but only with this set, namely the span of these time-like eigenvectors, this linear variety, because it's a linear subset, unified with another variety, namely the span of space-like eigenvectors. So this unification, because of the topological axioms, is clearly a variety. And then we intersect with the variety, so we have a nice sub-variety. So GR2 is the Kugler's name, it's the space of all planes. Space of all planes at a particular point. Good. So now back to this, to Ruffler's question about is this the unique maximal subvariety? Well, it's the maximal subvariety, that's for sure, if you construct it as such. And what is kind of interesting about this is that the subvariety is not a fixed thing, but it already depends on the curvature at each point. So in a sense, it's a very natural construction. It's fully covariant, as we will see in what sense this is really extremely nice. I just want to say, I think this is the only thing you can reasonably do, because you need something to construct this subvariety, and the only thing you have is your metric, okay, your connection, and your Riemann tensor, and this is the only thing that seems to make sense. In that sense, you need quite a lack of imagination. Yeah. But I think it's a good construction. Okay, so my technical key theory is the following. The following statements are trivial. Well, kind of this thing I start out with, I wanted to establish sectional curvature bounds, upper and lower ones, on a certain set. Now we saw in order to circumvent the Mogot theorem, we have to restrict ourselves to this maximal subvariety. Now, the sectional curvature is not a tensorial object. It's a geometrically well-defined object, but it's not a scalar. has the real value, but it's not defined in the vector space. It's not a tensor. So therefore, it's a bit of an awkward condition, because you have to check for, first of all, you have to construct this complicated thing. Second, you have to check actually for all elements to hear whether these conditions are satisfied. But with this restriction, we actually see this physically motivated condition is equivalent to that all eigenvalues rho of the Riemann tensor are bounded in the same way. But the eigenvalues are, of course, manifestly covariant thing, because the characteristic polynomial clearly is a manifestly covariant object. So we could see, we could have started from here and say, okay, let's introduce curvature bounds by bounding the eigenvalues of the Riemann tensor. But that doesn't make so nice contact to the physics I introduced at the beginning. So anyway, this is our nice criterion, and this also shows that this construction leads to something very natural.
Okay. But would this also say that all the eigenvalues are positive, right?
No, it's the absolute value.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I discussed it before, probably, but you got into trouble with getting arbitrarily large sections of curves.
Yeah.
If you looked only at the lower bound, would you avoid the trouble?
No, you don't.
If you get arbitrarily small,
Yeah. So these theorems are extremely robust. One could think, let's only restrict the sexual curvatures for time-like planes, or only for spatial ones, or let's only put upper bounds, or only lower bounds. In all these cases, you still have the rigidity theorem. It's extremely rigid.
So you can get arbitrarily appropriate local reference frame, you can get arbitrarily small sexual curvatures.
Yeah.
It's less easy to see how that works. That is kind of the same thing our team was talking about. It's a good physical intuition.
Right.
Or why they can be arbitrarily large. It's hard to see how they would be arbitrarily small.
Well, the thing is, okay, so I studied this theorem, the actual proof. And the actual proof proceeds by taking a sequence of planes that approach as a limit, time-like planes that approach as a limit annulment. And at first I thought this proof is kind of flawed, and it uses heavily continuity arguments. So we had this discussion recently that kind of continuity with respect to what are fourth quantity in the background, or with respect to the, I don't know, topology of the metric or whatever. And but it's, I think it's watertight. So I doubt the proof, and it's a rather abstract proof, because it uses this continuity argument. It has little insight of why it is so. At least I didn't see it in there. And so I have nothing to say to that. Let me just remark that what I just said, evaluation of a finite number, namely fundamentally six eigenvalue conditions maximally, is of course much simpler than this condition with this very complicated set. So that's kind of nice to have this criterion. And on Riemannian manifold, you can, as I hint at, diagonalize the Riemann tensor. Therefore, you have all the eigenvalues, and you find actually that this set V is the whole set of planes. And so on the Riemannian manifold, you can restrict to all, you do not need to restrict, which is what we knew from the beginning. So this was our final. Now, so what have we shown? We've shown that we cannot bound all sexual curvatures if we have a Lorentzian signature. Now, there is an analogy in electromagnetic theory. Namely, there you have the electromagnetic field strength FAB, you have the invariance F trace F squared, trace F star F, and these are E squared minus B squared and EB. Now, this minus comes from the Lorentz signature, and really, if we want to put an upper bound to electromagnetic field strength, we can only bound either of these two, and if you bound this one, you see you can bound E, but you cannot at the same time bound E, because there's this minus sign, and E and B, if they grow together, the difference will be arbitrarily small, so you never get an upper bound. Well, this is exactly what happens in Bohr-Einfeld theory. You only have an upper bound to the E field if your B field vanishes, or if the B field is there, then the upper bound to the E field will shift. Okay? So, although we cannot bound all of the field strength, doesn't mean that our theory is not regularized. Okay? And we will see this is also true in gravity. Actually, the original idea was bound all these sectional curvatures. Now I bound much less. We will see how little actually is sectional. Great example. But you could say, okay, so now we lose all the appeal of the original idea of bounding all the sectional curvatures. It turns out it's still a very strong condition in cooking standard and natural. So that's the analogy. Now the first example is
you say that you cannot bound the eigenvalues to the curvature tensor, the unit vectors in your map before lambda 2 is lambda 2, right? Then what does it mean that, are you saying that you can choose all the coordinate systems at any given point such that the eigenvalues?
No, the eigenvalues you can bound, because bounding the eigenvalues is equivalent to bounding the sectional curvature on this small subvariety. That you can do. No, that you can do. But you see, it doesn't correspond to having all sectional curvatures.
Right.
That's the idea.
Just a small comment. If you look at the magnetic example, it looked like there was a lower bound than E, because E squared minus B squared is supposed to be positive.
Yeah, but B could be bigger than E.
Yeah, but then there'll be a lower bound than one of them. Yeah, that's true. But in any given case, anyway. Can't, by playing with the plane, you can't make E squared out of the present small. If, say, E squared is greater than B squared. I mean, if that invariant happens to be positive.
Sure, so if you say if you have the upper bound, it also means something for the lower bound? Or?
No, I wasn't saying that. I was just saying, it's, in that case, it seems like you couldn't.
If it's positive, E squared can't be arbitrarily small.
Oh no, that's
not. Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, but there could be space times in which it was, and then you would have a global local.
Sure. But I mean, another.
If the analogy was good, it would suggest.
No. Okay, I just wanted to make this point. If you care about all the field strength, it's not the end of the day, and it's not. It's not a special thing of gravity that because of the Lorentzian signature you can't bound all of the fields. It's a weak analogy because it has structurally little in common.
In case of all the infill, so the two electric fields just really clear.
Yeah.
Just doesn't involve
what doesn't feel.
Well, I think he is not trying to continue. They're not related by the Lorentz.
Yeah. That's the same. You think I should have had EMD there?
You should have.
But I think E. No, I think E is found and D isn't.
E is not. E is E over R squared. And D is E over the finite length squared. You can't do both. It's not because of the signature. E is like E has a medium. What you feel going to the region. That's what causes the finite distance of show down.
So let's look at the static sphere in the symmetric case. We have these undetermined functions A and B. And we find out if we use these standard coordinates, then the resulting tensor, so these capital indices, I call the adjoint bases, are pairs of anti-symmetric indices. So in this adjoint basis, if you use the least coordinates, this thing is already diagonal. So not only is it diagonalizable, we already have chosen the nice coordinates on the standard Schwarzschild coordinates to find. Now, I can show you a picture of this set B, of this maximal subvariety. So rather than having all non-bound, it's the only planes that are left, these coordinates, is those that are perpendicular to the time axis and those that contain the time axis, so all these planes. You see, this is considerably much less than all the non-null planes. Okay. And so we really restrict a lot. But now the question is, if we restrict so much, what is still the contents? Well, we can show that the function B here cannot lie in these redly shaded regions. And if you require that you have asymptotically Minkowski, which you would have if you only have, would kind of seem reasonable if you only have upper bounds of sectional curvature, then B cannot lie in here either. So this comes out of these eigenvalue conditions. You can explicitly evaluate that. So B must run somehow like so. I don't know how here. But most interestingly, if you approach R equals to 0, B must go to 1. Now, it's an entirely independent argument by Holden, who says, whenever we want to dream up a gravity with regulated spherical symmetric solutions, B must go, as R goes to 0, B must go to 1. It's an entirely independent argument. It's rather complicated. But it's remarkable. We do something entirely different, we come to the same thing. So this hints already at the fact that if I impose these section curvature bounds only on this restricted set, I already get a regularized solution. And if you then further look at what A can do, A can only be positive, and it can at most touch R axis, meaning there can be, so light cones will always be upright, and then they can tilt, but then they must immediately tilt back instead of completely tilting over like you would have in the Schwarzschild solution if you have a null surface. So you can have a null surface like this, like this horizon, but then it's not a proper horizon because kind of things, well, if there's only a little bit of fluctuation, things could easily escape. So this horizon is kind of permeable. But this would be a pathological, well, not pathological, but an extreme case anyway. So that's this thing. So that's only the upper bounds. And actually, one can argue that with asymptotic Lyapunov constant, you can say with only upper bounds on this restricted set of planes, you find there exists no space-like singularities in static spherical symmetric spacetimes. So whenever we had a gravity theory that would produce solutions that respect these upper bounds, we would not have black holes in the static black holes in the normal sense.
Well, but you would expect that tidal forces approach infinity as you approach a singularity.
Yeah, but we didn't bound all tidal forces.
No,
we only very few, and still we have this regularization. That is what's surprising to
me. This is much more radical than that, because it's saying you can't even go a little bit inside the horizon of structure. Isn't that what it's saying?
It's saying that.
Did I understand? You couldn't even have as much of a Schwarzschild solution as there would be if you just went a small way inside the horizon.
Oh, you mean you can't even enter the horizon?
That's what I thought you just showed. Maybe I didn't understand the fixture.
Because Schwarzschild is not.
A tiny light particle could go right through here. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yes, it could, but
yeah.
But then you have the cones tilting back up.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what that means. That's not what happens in the standard coordinates.
No, it doesn't. No, of course not.
But Schwarzschild is not a boundary.
That's the point.
Schwarzschild is not an example of a boundary.
Schwarzschild could never satisfy this upper bound.
So you're not only ruling out the singularity of Schwarzschild.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, no.
You're ruling out everything.
Schwarzschild is completely, I mean, if this is true, Schwarzschild is completely off the target. So that's the point.
You, for example, planet, right? Outside of where the planet is, in this place you can watch it.
Oh, nobody, okay, look, this A actually, if you derive the A, you should get the gravitational force and the low velocity limit. And the weak field limit, low velocity, if you write, I mean, Schwarzschild solution 1 minus 2m over r, okay, so you can read off from the A, you can read off the potential. So nobody, you see, this has enough space to have A in the region where you need it behave properly. How it really behaves, I have to show you dynamics, which I'm going to do. But this is just a kinematical restriction. So already the kinematics of upper bounds on sectional curvatures on this restricted set completely exclude space-like similarities in this case. That's my claim at this point.
So you can have those solutions that look just like Schwarzschild solution, but excluding otherwise.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So I mean, at least kinematically, that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In Schwarzschild geometry, if you square the point of the text, close by 1,
yeah.
You don't see any randomizer. The randomizer is important to put. So if you feel push for extension,
the point is, we haven't studied particular solutions. I mean, this is just any symmetrical
system.
Yeah, any space time would be.
It's just a kinematical thing.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I come to the dynamics. Suppose we should just
go
back
to
the dynamics.
I'm
concerned about it. So what time is it?
Five.
It's 5?
It's moved to the dynamics.
Okay. Okay, so. So yeah, I need to show you this example. If you have upper bounds, so B cannot lie in this region. If you have lower bounds, B cannot lie in those regions either. So these are two different scenarios that can come up. So B can only lie either like here in this yellow region, scenario one, or in this yellow region, scenario two. No one can show, because it also gets nice conditions on A, that it's more straight, that it's monotonous everywhere. This scenario can never produce a capillary region, that was Hutton's question. But this scenario can. So, and the point is, this scenario will never have a singularity, it will never have a horizon. Not even this spurious one. So if you have lower and upper bounds, there are no static black holes in any theory that produces all lower and upper bounds, if otherwise the solutions are phenomenologically acceptable. So it doesn't have solutions like this. If you exclude this, is the task of particular dynamics to ensure that. So we skip example three. We can't, because I can ask. So here you have the PP wave space type, and they're all curvature invariant spanners. So even if the Riemann tensor is non-zero, these space types have all curvature invariants completely vanished. So, this first sight is a bit surprising, but it also shows you that kind of in this eigenvalue equation, all our eigenvalues are zeros, so clearly lie between any finite bounds. And so you can never avoid null singularities with any substitute. If you say, I don't want any curvature invariants to explode, then you can never exclude null singularities. Okay, this is because all curvature invariants may vanish and still space-time may not be trivial. It's an important point. I speed up a little bit here. Okay, so that was kinematical considerations. Obviously, the question is, what possible gravitational dynamics will have those solutions? Clearly not Einstein-Hilbert. But I show you a whole class. I mean, the class looks like this. Take the Riemann endomorphism, plug it into a function f, and then take the trace, really produces the scalar, you have the density, so you have a valid action. And this f is supposed to be a holomorphic function, holomorphic on this annulus. Okay. So clearly, this is a whole lot of theories. Okay. And this ambiguity simply reflects our ignorance what the exact quantum space-time structure is. So my claim is these curvature bounds come from the quantum space-time structure. Now I can tell you what I think that is in detail, and so I have a whole lot of theories which kind of are possible reflections. Okay, so this is ambiguity. And now a technical point, because that is holomorphic on an annulus, it has a Lowrand expansion, so kind of the scalar part and this, these inverse powers, and it's absolutely convergent, and that is absolutely necessary because we want to reorder the sequence. We can couple matter as usual because the Miller constraint applies to actually this guy here, the Galilei effect still exists. Now we derive equations of motion, and most importantly, they contain this trace f of R term. Now, if you think of the convergence properties of this f, and this appears in the equation of motion, you see no real solution of this theory could ever violate these curvature bounds, because this term would become ill-defined or undefined over the real numbers if the curvature of the eigenvalues here would leave the prescribed bounds by this defined by the borders of this annulus. Okay, so in that way, these kind of borders of the annulus establish these curvature bounds. Okay, this is a whole lot of theories, and one could write down a particular one, but what's the point, because we don't know which one. Okay, but now, note, these equations are fourth order in derivatives, that means the phase space is bigger, it means there are more degrees of freedom. So, you use just a symmetric metric, but there's still more degrees of freedom, but they're hidden kind of in this non-triviality. Make no remarks later on that. So we have as many theories as Laurent series on an annulus. Interestingly, the classical limit at this point is still defined, because we have two bounds. And taking both bounds away, we would come to the standard space dimension without bounds. If you have two bounds and you take them away, we have to say how one goes with respect to the other. Many possibilities. And so far, I haven't shown you how to do that yet. So it's not quite clear at this point how to do it. In fact, we need a new theoretical input. And we use Minkowski as an exact solution because of the lower bounds. and that may be virtue of the presence of accelerated universe. Anyway, so now we perform this classical limit because of time reasons, and we just think how it goes. It turns out you can get a good prescription of how to take one limit with respect to the other if you only put in that you want that the resulting theory has an exact solution of constant curvature. About solutions of this F of R theory, I know nothing. But now make an additional requirement, namely some constant curvature solution space as a solution. If you do that, you can actually show that you have to take these limits in a certain way, and then you end up with the fact that the coefficients of the negative exponents in the series are fully determined by the coefficients in the Taylor part of the series. You have infinitely many theories, and now you have only half as much left. And, okay, but you decided on this curvature K to be a solution to the theory. So if you take one limit to one limit to zero, the other one to infinity, you aim at keeping this K, this exact solution, always an exact solution in this process. Okay? So that takes care of the relation between the two limits. And the result is, a whole family of gravities which have no more curvature bounds because we removed them in a particular way. But interesting, so we removed the resulting curvature bounds. We write down your theories, we remove these curvature bounds with the assumption that the constant curvature solution is an exact solution. So you would expect Einstein Hilbert plus cosmological term. But in fact, what comes out from this root is Einstein Hilbert, because this trace over R is Einstein Hilbert, plus the trace over the inverse of this. Of the Riemann endomorphism, factor k squared being the constant curvature solution that I picked, for example, because I see a cosmological constant.
So delta is constant?
No, delta is one keystroke away here. Delta is a dimensional factor, and interestingly, the dimension, two dimensions, oh, I forgot to mention, these rigidity theorems only hold dimension three upwards. Two dimensions they don't hold. And in two dimensions, we have no additional term. But it's not very interesting anyway, two-dimensional gravity. And but then we only always have a negative contribution here. So in four dimensions minus one third. It's purely dimensional factor. Okay. So I didn't put in Einstein at all. So I take curvature bounds, I take them away, I pick Minkowski as my favorite vacuum solution, and I get Einstein. That's something that's in a sense reassuring, because that's what one would expect. There is no actual cosmological constant term, because this has a very different character. And this is the whole family of gravities, but if you have observations of the expanding universe, you clearly have this determined by the cosmological constant. Now, people look at theories F of a Ricci scalar. Well, that's very different from what we did, because we have here the Riemann tensor in here, and in particular the trace of the inverse eigenvalues is not the inverse of the trace of the eigenvalues. Okay? And this is in fact a much more complicated theory, but we understand that it comes from geometry. I already said we have more degrees of freedom than standard gravity. Actually, you can show if this was the Ricci scalar, R plus 1 over Ricci scalar, then there is an additional scalar degree of freedom that you can make explicit when this is a scalar tensor theory. So in this additional term, because the phase space is bigger, because the degree of motion of fourth order, the kind of degrees of freedom hidden that you wouldn't think of when you just look at the center. So this, of course, has implications, because I mean, if you, for example, want to quantize, you need to quantize all degrees of freedom, not just there is no Einstein frame. There's no way to rescale this theory so that it looks like ordinary Einstein plus some matter, right, conformally scaled. Okay? So in a sense, this is therefore irreducible. It's not a scalar tensor, scalar spinner, or whatever theory. Okay, now, of course, so this is the classical limit without curvature bounds. It would be interesting to see what are cosmological solutions, what are the explicit spherical symmetries. They have these bounds, how they can only look like possibly, but how do they really look like for this thing? And it's really difficult to do that, at least when we work. So we could do perturbation theory. Actually, this whole thing is designed such that it's compatible with perturbation theory, and we'll explain it in detail. And of course, lots of things from kind of discussed or takes this seriously. So, it's kind of just a statement. The quotient problem must be studied anew. It cannot just be reduced to Einstein plus some matter where you then study the quotient problem in that matter, which is rather simple. This is not possible here because there's no Einstein. Okay, so a quick summary is, we looked at sectional curvatures, and they explained a good normalized measure for tidal accelerations, and the heuristic argument was they are bounded by a quantum field. Now, we cannot immediately translate this program of bounded sectional curvatures into good geometry because we have the rigidity of Lorentzian manifolds. We cannot bound all sectional curvatures, therefore we cannot remove all curvature singularities, for example, the null singularities, which certainly don't get rid of. We bound the sectional curvature for the maximal subvariety of all planes, and that is equivalent to this nice condition of the bounds for angles of the Riemann tensor. If we have upper bounds, we clearly remove the Schwarzschild singularity and actually completely alter the Schwarzschild. The Schwarzschild solution has no place whatsoever in any such theory, and the lower bounds remove the Minkowski-Lange one. The dynamics are given by this trace F, but crucially this is the endomorphism, not only the scalar, but this is the homomorphic function of animals. We require constant curvature solutions, and that fixes some half of the coefficients. And so after having done all that stuff, it's useful for these curvature bounds, we take them away again in a well-defined manner, and then we arrive at a unique theory. So here there was a lot of ambiguity because we don't know where it really comes from, how it is in detail, but the classic limit removing these signatures leads to a classical theory, which has most notably this terminated Laurent Zipper solutions. What should be studied, which is difficult, is the quotient problem stability questions, exact solutions for this type of theory. It would be very interesting. And let's show the philosophical point is to have a blues, the curvature bounds is better than never having had.
You can show that if you take a Einstein nuclear hyperfunctional invariant expansion, then to the scale of all the curvature invariants, you can show that this theory has closes all the curvature invariants because of a positive negative residues in the geometric property. So, all these theories are unstable. So what we need is a theory with nuclear number and nuclear theory to attempt to scale curve. Then you get a branch cut. These boats disappear. If you get into a five-dimensional gravity theory, it's a fifth dimension, you can use a branch cut and all the residues. The way you can find is the food.
Right.
And so